In the world of Torah, there's many, many, many laws. It's a reason why so many Jewish people are lawyers. It's because it crept into the genes after thousands of years of learning. And to be a rabbi meant to study at least a good portion of the laws so that you could at least have a practical knowledge of those laws for the people of the city who didn't have time to learn. Right? They were trying to eke out a livelihood in sometimes the most difficult of circumstances and places. More often than not, the rabbi ended up as the answer man. People didn't go to the books to look up questions. They went to the rabbi, and the rabbi was hopefully a great scholar and knew how to separate between one law and the next and how to apply it in difficult life situations. Well, that's good for the rabbi because he knows what he's doing, but for the average person, they didn't really know what they were doing. And so there was a Hasidic Rebbe, a great master, and a student who really didn't know that much. Now, anybody knows, if you know the laws, that during the holiday of Sukkot, that when the time comes to build this little hut that you live in for 7 days, that the hut has minimal dimensions to it. It's not just any kind of hut, it's a hut with laws, right? As most everything is. And so there's a minimal size. It has to be so tall and so wide. And the basic law is you have to fit rosho verubo. You have to fit at least your head, and most of you has to fit in it. Like if you had a washing machine container, you know, a box from a washing machine, you could get in there. That could be a sukkah. If you put a little palm leaf or two on the top, maybe even a little smaller if you're small, and you could stick the head and most of you in it. It could be a sukkah. So next year, I expect to see a lot of boxes by my friends. But one student, he didn't really know the laws too well. And so it was, he was returning for the holiday of Sukkot and driving his little wagon through the big forests of Russia. And he gets lost. And it's hard. Path gets covered up maybe a little bit, and you take a wrong turn, and you don't know where you are any longer. You're in the middle of a big forest. The holiday of Sukkot is coming, and now he's lost. He has no way to fulfill the mitzvah. He gets lost for days, and now he says, what am I going to do? I have no walls to put the branches on. And he doesn't know the laws. He doesn't know how to make things right. So in his simplicity, he thinks it over and he comes up with a brilliant idea. You know, like every Hasidic student, he was wearing a hat. And he had one of these broad-brimmed hats with a big top on the top. And he decided he's going to cut off the top of his hat, make a hole, and put branches on the top. So then his head is under the sukkah. So he, and the idea is brilliant in his own estimation. So happy he is that he's not going to miss out on the mitzvah of Sukkah, on this special observance during the holiday, that he's dancing wildly. Because he was so sad just a little while before, thinking that he was going to miss. So he's dancing and rejoicing just because he's able to do this good deed, this good action in the world. Why is it good? Because his whole heart is given to God. So he gets branches, puts them on his head. He doesn't know this has nothing to do with the mitzvah. It doesn't fulfill the sukkah at all. But when he comes back to town and he sees the Rebbe said, you caused a commotion in heaven. He said, they didn't like your sukkah so much, but they just loved your joy. And so no doubt it was the best sukkah around. Because ultimately it's what you offer in your heart that really gets taken up. It's not always what's on your head. You know, to forget yourself in joy is really a lot of what this holiday is about. We've heard it so many times before that between the Infinite One and between you and I, there's a wall that conceals, with a type of an illusion, the Eternal One from you and I. Right? There's a wall. And that wall we call the ego of a person. Right? If it weren't for this ego, the light would stream in. So, the task at hand for those who were understanding was, how do you diminish the ego? This thing that you spent all your life building, you invested in it from the time you were little, because you needed one, apparently, in order to feel that you're a person, in order to negotiate the world. And while you were building, you built special equipment into the ego, right? Little specialty items that make you uniquely you. And of course, like most people, you become proud, or at the minimal, attached, of what it is that you've built for yourself. And so when somewhere a little bit later, because as in childhood we don't hear these kinds of teachings. If you were exposed to religion, of any religion, not just Judaism, but all religions, essentially, at some point in time when you reach maturity, they're going to say, now it's time to diminish what you just built. And each one prescribes certain ways, sometimes exacting methods, how to diminish this ego, so that the beauty of the streaming light can shine into the cavern of darkness that has become your isolated, private, personal world. And so you start with a very solid ceiling of ego, and you're trying to remove from that ceiling something that will allow the light to stream in. And of course, that's what the sukkah is about. We hear this, the ceiling of the sukkah has to have holes in it where light comes in. It has to be enough there that it protects you from the sun so you don't get burnt from it. But on the other hand, it can't be a solid roof. It has to have light streaming in too. And so it reminds us of diminishing this solid structure. But how? Well, there are numerous ways. One of the most famous ways to diminish the ego is suffering. That for many people, when they suffer in life, it grinds away like sandpaper at the rough edges of the ego. That a person is arrogant and bold and thinks they own the world and control life. And then after suffering comes, it starts to smooth them out, humble them a little bit. Because they see in response to every attempt that they make to control their life and to force the hand of God, they're met with some kind of club. Not the kind you want to join. Right. But the kind that humbles you. And through enough suffering, a person starts softening. Although some people, even still with suffering, they become very bitter. And in their bitterness, they become angry. And in their anger, they become hateful. And they die that way. The wall of the ego, the ceiling of the ego, was really never opened up enough. And it waits, because life after life, journey after journey, in this endless journey of experience that we go through, God has plenty of time for the ego to be opened. But those who have suffered greatly, I, with a longing eye, the possibility of an opening in the near future. Maybe even an opening right now. So suffering is the way that you don't choose, it chooses you. And it's fairly common for one and all. But this holiday is the teaching of diminishing the ego through joy, not through suffering. The holiday of Sukkot is about diminishing the ego through joy. That joy has an interesting property to it. That when you become really happy, you forget yourself. You forget, by and large, most of the defenses that built up as ego defenses. Because the ego, after all, knows it's very frail. No matter how well it's able to fool other people, no matter how good a game you talk, or you dress, or you display with your money, or your intelligence, or your strength, no matter how good of a game you play in the world to convince others that you're strong and in control, well, you always know a little bit better. And so, for a person's ego who knows that the ego is really kind of a front, a show, in order not to hear that inside themselves, in order not to hear that what they're presenting isn't really real, they need the constant approval of their ego of other people. Right? Other people will be relied upon to give them a sense that the ego is real. Yes, you really are that. You really are in control. You're wonderful, you're beautiful, you're strong, you're wealthy, you're important. But inside, the person can say, I don't believe it enough today. I need some more. And so really, the person who is caught up in sustaining this ego construction is also caught up in begging. Even though they would never think of it in that light as begging, but really it's approval seeking. That I really can't feel good unless somebody else tells me I'm okay. Even though I disguise all that in some other kind of subtlety, some other kind of game. So the ego being insecure by its nature, and that is essentially true, that the ego is insecure in itself by nature, then in its insecurity it does need a lot of defense, self-defense. It's always going to be under attack from something or another, whether it's nature, whether it's other people, whether it's self-incrimination. A person attacks themselves. So the ego invests a lot of its budget in self-defense. Just like nations. There's a lot of money spent in defense because you never know. Well, as long as a person remains living in this construction, there's always fear. Fear becomes a permanent partner. And yet we hear of these enlightened sages that have tried to help and guide us through their experience, that essentially they were fearless. which is equivalent to egoless. Now, being egoless doesn't mean to be a broken person, like the ego would imagine egoless to be. Because the ego imagines, if you take away what I am, then I'll be nothing. In other words, I'll be absolutely worthless scum, broken, depressed. That's how the ego pictures egolessness. But the ego is the last one you should ask for descriptions of the egoless state. That department is reserved specially for tzaddikim. People who have lost the ego, at least to a great degree, and the most saintly, where it has vanished. And they give to us the teaching that the egoless state is not a broken state, it's not a state of depression, it's not a state of, like you would think. But rather, it is an immensely joyous condition of being. Just the opposite of what the ego would paint in its assessment. And so a person who has no ego can be very quiet because they need nothing, essentially. Or on the other hand, they could be outspoken. There would be no necessary form that it would have to take. It would take the form that was required for its part in its service at that moment in time. In other words, the egoless state is completely aware of its own service in the divine plan. And it becomes whatever is needed for that time. Sometimes quiet, sometimes loud. But when we refer to our handbook of egolessness that is written by the ego, we would see a very, very different picture. We say, well, humble people can never raise their voice. Humble people can't dance. Humble people can't do this or that. And we have a picture of a broken person, perhaps. And our sages say, no, don't follow that way. There is one thing that is stable and steady in the egoless condition, and that is joy. Whether the joy is quiet or whether it is manifest openly, it is joyful. Now, even greater to know is that when one is still working with the ego condition, that is the condition of suspicion, of defensiveness, of jealousy, of anger, of lust, all of these qualities come out of the ego. They're all born of a sense of lack and limit. When this ego creature is given some degree of joy, even if it starts as some type of material introduction to joy, like for a simple person, give them a good meal, or listen to some beautiful music, or dance, or get together with a friend, or have a glass of wine, or whatever it is that you as a person normally would do, this would be an introduction at the life level into joy. Something you could recognize tangibly right now, here. But this tangible introduction has the ability, if taken deeply enough, to actually suspend and even annihilate the ego if carried deeper, with a greater intensity. And so you would find within a Hasidic world, for instance, that many people, even in the midst of difficult circumstances in life, where livelihood wasn't working well, or their marriage wasn't working out that well, or they had trouble with their children, a time when you just don't feel like doing anything to make yourself happy because you don't have the energy, that is specifically when they would say, okay, it's time to do something about it. And they would call up friends and they'd get together, have a glass of wine, and begin to dance. And people would say, how can you dance? Don't you know what's happening in your life? And they'd say, please, be quiet. I don't want to be taken over by sadness. I'm on the verge of being conquered by sadness, and sadness is the mechanism that establishes the ego. Sadness, in other words, makes the ego's reality more real. And what does that do to me ultimately? It cuts me off from God. I need the roof in my head to be open like the top of the sukkah. I need at least a little light streaming in. And so one of my important lessons in life is when I start to tilt towards the side of sadness, I have to be resourceful to know how to emerge from that sadness. And it's very difficult for me as an ordinary person to fall into sadness and contemplate the deepest of the deep at that time in order to bring myself out. Sometimes a simple little pleasure is just what I need to begin the spark that will ignite the engine, that once it's going, it'll turn over by itself. But I need a starter. And so our teacher said, use what you will to start the starter. But don't stop there. Go deeper into joy. Until you feel the sadness giving way. And what inevitably happens is that when one learns that, when one is able to actually live that, they see that the way a problem looks when you're sad is not the way it looks when you're happy. It doesn't mean when you're happy you're a fool and you ignore difficulties. But rather, solutions take a different course altogether. That what your solution was when you were sad is an altogether different course of action than the way you would see it when you were immersed in a type of joy. Yet, sadly enough, we usually make the decisions and solutions when we're really sad. That we assess the situation from sadness, arrive at a sad conclusion, and act out that sad conclusion, which only amplifies the sadness. 9 times out of 10, that decision will not be really good for you. And then you'll see, I told you so. I told you this wasn't going to work. I knew I didn't have a chance of succeeding from this? Well, of course. Mochin de katnut, mochin de gadlut. Little brain, big brain. Little brain is when you make your decisions when you're sad. Big brain is when you make them when you're happy. So sukha is about learning to make decisions when you're happy, to delay sometimes a decision until you've moved yourself from one place to the other. And there's another meaning in the word sukha. Sohe, sukha, and sohe are connected. Sohe is a word which is used rarely in the Torah, but it has to do with seeing. But not just any type of seeing, it has to do with seeing with spiritual vision. Like a prophet would see such a way. One would see the future or see a distant place or see what a person was doing in their life. That type of seeing. That word is connected to the sukha. In other words, this holiday is also about the celebration of regaining your sight. But not just your physical vision, but your ability to see in the deepest way. That much of life we spend time seeing just the surfaces of things. And what are the surfaces of things? They're really our own self. On the surface, all we can see is what we've already interpreted life to be. I am so full of judgments, biases, and prejudices in my mind that on the surface, all I can see, even though I don't think that's what I'm seeing, is myself. I don't like that one. I think that one's great. I think this one's too tall. This one's too short. But really what I'm doing is just seeing me. Everywhere, always. I am so lost inside myself when I see only on the surface that it's not just the ego is on the inside, it's everywhere. It's a giant bubble. And I'm trapped inside of it, inside, outside. I need, during this time, to practice being happy. But how happy? So happy. So happy that I get my sight back. Because it is so that the happier that a person gets, the more their eyes clear up. They begin to see through the surface of things to layers that are just behind the surface. And there are multiple layers behind the surface. It's not just a little deep, it's very deep, right behind the surface. Each layer of depth you would call another world. In other words, if we had eyes to see, when I'm seeing the surface, I'm just seeing this world. I'm seeing people, their clothing, their cars, their houses, the sky, the trees, the wind. But what if my eyes clear up a little bit? What do I see? I see the next world. The next world that is coexisting right here, but it's right behind the superficial world. It's here all the time. It's not that the world, the next level, goes anywhere. It just remains concealed behind ego eyes. How deep can I see? Layer after layer after layer after layer. And it's so deep. and perhaps you would realize, like a prophet would realize, that it's infinite and that it's all just God forever. At the surface, all the way to the endless depths. Then how could they not be overwhelmed with awe and with love, seeing what they would see? Of course, if you only see the surface, for a little while you have awe and love when you meet something new in your life, but then it wears off. Then awe goes to sleep, love becomes occasional. But what if you could see? The more you can see, the more awe and the more love you have. The more those attributes are awakened. Now, take a look at surface seeing for a minute. Surface seeing, we already said, was dominated by the ego. The ego is dominated by fear. And part of fear is defense and suspicion. So what do we say when a person looks suspicious? What do we say about their eyes? They have shifty eyes. Right? In other words, their eyes are always moving back and forth. They're looking here, there, because they're scared. They're always checking out everything all the time because they're scared. Well, the eyes are really a reflection of the condition of mind. Right? If the mind is turbulent, then the eyes will be turbulent. Like we learned in meditation class yesterday, we said, how do we know when a person's dreaming, going through experiences in their head? Rapid eye movement. We know that a person is going through mentalizing, experiencing a mental world, because their eyes are moving all over. Whereas when a person goes into deep sleep, profound rest, rejuvenation, the eyes are quiet, steady. So shifty eyes belong to the ego, to the world, to the fear and the suspicion. And steady eyes belong to the soul. Steady eyes belong to the soul. Now, it's hard enough to shift in your consciousness from small brains to big brains, from little consciousness to great consciousness. It's hard to make this shift. Like we said, sometimes you have to do the silliest things to prompt a beginning of that shift. But one of the ancient ways that was learned to help make this shift, to help reduce the influence of the ego and its sadness and its fear, to awaken larger consciousness, is to stabilize the eyes. That is, that if you would pick a spot to look at and hold your eyes glued to it, and not move it, even though your mind is wild. At the beginning, the wild mind will try to make your eyes move all over. And quite naturally, they will want to, because it's their job to reflect the mind. But with a little bit of willpower, just a little bit, you take your eyes and you lock them in a position. Then you reverse the process by an interesting circular connection. That not only the state of mind controls the eyes, but the eyes can control the state of mind. When the eyes are taken and solidified, locked, then the mind begins to calm down. If you're patient. This technique in ancient times was called histaklut. It was called staring. And if you look at the pictures, even of the modern day great masters, one thing you'll notice in their picture most often is their eyes are locked. And you say, well, everybody's eyes are locked in a picture. No, that's not what you see. Look carefully at their eyes. You see a kind of a steadiness there. And that steadiness is the reflection of the mind as it has calmed and locked. As the mind quiets down and stops thinking about all the things that it normally thinks, the ego begins to diminish. Because after all, the ego is made up of a collection of thoughts. And if this steady series of thoughts, which never really seems to stop because the ego never really lets go, because it has a lot to be scared of, it has a lot to control, it has a lot to talk about. But if this understanding is communicated clearly, then one would understand that if they would lock their eyes and slowly influence the stream of thought in mind so that the stream becomes quieter, then the ego will diminish in the quietness of mind. And you will move from the condition of sadness to joy, from fear to love, from ego to big brains. Now, if this joy is made to grow because the mind becomes well-trained, then one can actually lose themselves in this joy. Right? The ego begins to vanish. The personal self, in other words, let's reframe it. The personal self who lives the life of effort, that is sincerely of the belief that they need to control everything. Not only their own behavior and life, but everyone else's. As the mind becomes quiet and fear begins to dissipate, and the conversation of the ego diminishes, then there is a bubbling up of joy, a streaming in of light, that makes no sense whatsoever to that ego character. They say, well, wait a minute, why do I feel joyful when I haven't found any object that's bringing me this joy? Because the ego's nature is, give me something to like and then I'll be happy. And this happiness is not based on an object. In fact, it's based on the opposite. It's based on the cessation of objects. It's based on quietness itself. That type of joy is the beginning of your sight. Your sight is returning. Okay. one last teaching here. Besides this advantage that we can find in learning to stabilize the sight, the eyes, there is also the approach of developing a good eye, it's called in the Torah. It's a good eye, Ayin Tova. A good eye means that as you're living the everyday life and you are looking at situations as they unfold, that a good eye will choose to interpret the situation in a positive way. It will choose to see the good in people, in situations, as opposed to trying to bring out always the critical eye, which sometimes is needed, but when it gets out of hand, it starts to criticize everything. It's like a pet, a dog, that you would like it to bark if somebody's coming into your yard to warn you, but you don't want it to bark at everybody and go to bite everybody. And so too with your sight, you don't want to develop critical sight in such a way that you're attacking everyone always. That even before you have a chance to catch yourself, you've already made the judgment. Ayin Tova, a good eye, means that generally everything is guided by the attribute of chesed, of loving kindness. That first you try to see the good. If it becomes clear after careful looking that this is a problem, this is something that needs correction, even the good eye is allowed to see the necessary correction and work towards that correction. But a good eye starts from the position of chesed. Chesed, or loving kindness, is the dominating attribute in that character. It governs all the life situations as a first approach. So this type of seeing belonged in the Torah world, belonged to a particular character who represents that. And it just happens to be his night during the holiday now, because of all the seven nights of the holiday of Sukkot, each night has what's called a holy guest, a holy personality from the past that comes and visits us on that night. And tonight, the high priest comes, Aaron. This is the brother of Moses, of Moshe. Now, being the high priest, and this is his night and his teaching, it was his way to see the good in everyone. In other words, he made it his life's work to go out among the people and to give to each and every person that he would meet honor and respect. To see the good in them. This was Aharon's way. And people, how would they react to this? Well, he was one of the most important people in the whole nation, a person of the greatest admiration and reverence. Yet he would circulate among everyone, always looking at the good in them, showing them respect and honor, treating them in conversation as if their opinion was just as important as his. Their life was just as meaningful as his. In other words, he would see God in everyone. He was so beloved in the nation because he brought such honor to everyone that the people couldn't bear it when he died. They were just completely broken. There was never a person more loved than him, because there was never a person who loved more. Now, the holiday of Sukkot is especially connected to him, even though he has just one night among the seven. But some of the sages say that this holiday is really, the little huts that we built are really symbolic of the clouds of glory that surrounded the nation after we left Egypt and traveled through the desert. Right? It said that the nation was surrounded by clouds. And these clouds were acting as shade for us from the harsh sun of the desert. And they did many other miraculous things, these clouds. One of the things they did was clean our clothes. It said that they never had to wash their clothes for 40 years because the clouds would come and just kind of come over you and wash your clothes out. And they were fresh. So the Sukkot, these little huts, are really the clouds. Because just like the clouds surrounded above us to shade us from the harsh sun and went all around us to clean our clothes, so too the Sukkah is above us and around us in remembrance of the clouds. And the sages complete their teaching by saying, and why were there clouds when we traveled through the desert? The clouds came bizichut Aharon, in the merit of the holiness of Aaron. In other words, this one man was so holy, was so filled with divine love, that in his existence alone in the world, the beauty of his existence turned into clouds which covered the nation. That everyone benefited by him being there. That if a person can love that deeply, can show that much respect to other people in life, it brings good to everyone, not just to the few, but to everyone. So we learn to lock our eyes, to quiet the mind, to diminish the ego. But sometimes we're not walking around looking like a zombie, you know. Don't practice that at work, they'll kick you out. At work you need to look around, your eyes need to be moving. When you talk to your friends, move your eyes a little. But make sure when your eyes are moving that you have a good eye. Following the example of Aaron. Make sure that when they're moving nicely. Hevedan et kol adam lechav zuchut. Make sure that you judge each person with favor, to the side of good. Even if in the end you must decide that this person is not good to associate with, that this person is a poor influence in my life, that this person could not be my business partner. Even if in the end that's where you must decide, but but you did it with a good eye. It's different than doing it with a vicious eye, Ayin Ra, an evil eye.